All right, let's start. This is our last class, class four of the four class series on the Yoga Sutra, the aphorisms on yoga, on union with your true nature, with who you really are. And before I start, I'd like to thank the people that brought us here, especially Carl and Denise, and to the people at Inner Jewel Dharma for all the volunteer work that you did. And y'all made us feel right at home. And very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So just a quick review, because there's a couple of people. You're coming for the first time? First class? All right, we'll start over. So just a quick review. Yoga is defined in the Yoga Sutra in the second verse. Everyone say it. Yoga
Sutra.
Yoga is the cessation of the turbulence of the mind. The stopping of the mind going ape crap. The monkey mind on LSD slaked with speed. So, you know the vrittis, the turnings, the churnings of the mind over and over again. Another way that you could look at that definition is yoga is the practice of learning how to be unselfconscious. Unselfconscious. Because that self-consciousness is another way of talking about the churnings of the mind, isn't it? Self-consciousness means that little voice inside your head that keeps yabbering all the time. Everyone got one of those? Good. Glad I'm not the only one. And it drives us crazy. That little voice drives us crazy. And we find that we get relief from that little voice inside our heads once in a while, and then we are so happy. That is kind of what happiness is when that little voice shuts up already. And we can fully integrate samadhi, fully integrate with somebody, something, some experience, you know, or the life as a whole. The cosmos as a whole. But, we have little intimations in our daily lives of what samadhi feels like, what it feels like to not have to be you, say your name to yourself, to not have to be somebody, to not have to be self-conscious. Self-consciousness is identity, It's kind of who you are, is that little voice inside, who you think you are, It defines us, right? And mostly we go through life thinking, well, I wanna be more of a somebody. I want that voice to be speaking like more loudly and egotistically and magnanimously, big. I want a bigger me, a bigger self, supersize me. And think, and if you think that that's the goal of a spiritual path, you are sorely mistaken. If you think that the goal of any spiritual path, yoga or, Buddhism or Christianity or any of them, is to supersize your ego, that is a big mistake. It is au contraire. It is exactly the opposite of that. The opposite of that is to be nobody. As there's a book written by someone. Is there a book? Oh, really? What a coincidence. is to learn gradually to get in touch with your true nature, which is not somebody. It is not an individual. It's not a particular thing. It is a universal thing. It is a cosmic thing. And it is a thing that we all share equally. And we all are it. And none of us is it more than any of it, the rest of us. So yoga is about trying to still that somebody voice, to quiet it down, to silence it. And so pay attention in your life. During retroactively, okay? Retrospectively. You can only do it retrospectively because if you're paying attention to it when it happens, it isn't happening. Because then you're self-conscious again. But in those moments when you are unself-conscious, when you are not there in a way, when the somebody self shuts up already, is when we are happiest. It's when we are happiest, when we can merge, when we can feel the union, the yoga of ourselves and what's happening in life, so that there's not this distance between the me and the world, you know? That's an illusion anyway, but it's an illusion that we cling on to at our own peril, to our own dukkha, our suffering. We suffer because we think that we're separate. We suffer because we think we're alone. We suffer because we think we're discrete, cut off from other beings and from life itself and from the universe as a whole. We feel like there's me and there's the world, right? And with that kind of illusory, you know, feeling, it's illusory, but it's still a strong feeling, right? Just because it doesn't exist doesn't mean it doesn't function, if you know what I mean. Just because it's a dream doesn't mean it doesn't, like, you know, make you cry and wake yourself up screaming and stuff. It's a dream. It's the world, the way we think we live in the world is a dream. It's like a dream. But it functions and it brings us dukkha. Dukkumevam sarvam, as it says in the Yoga Sutra, right? It's all suffering when you have that kind of conception of who you are and how you relate to the world. You feel alone and you feel in an adversarial relationship with other people and with life. You know, it's kind of, you're the last stand at the Alamo. You know, just you and versus all the enemies out there, trying to get you, trying to hurt you, trying to get ahead of you, trying to get resources that you want, and so forth. Big rat race when we have that kind of conceptualization of how we are and how we exist in the world. So the opposite of that, when the mind, when there is a cessation, when there's a nirodha, when those vrittis stop, when the self-consciousness stop, we feel a sense of a re-identity. We re-identify ourselves in a totally unself-conscious way. We get in touch with a deeper sense of our identity. We feel a sense of deep belonging. In fact, so deep that we can't separate ourselves from that to which we belong. There's no separation in me. There's no sense of me versus anything else. That is the mystical experience that all the traditions talk about. The mystics in all the traditions. And they talk about it in different ways, don't they? You know, in the Christian tradition, they talk about meeting God or chit-chatting with Jesus or having some angel, you know, whatever. And other traditions talk about it differently. I had the direct perception of emptiness. These are all just words, okay? This is, in the Yoga Sutra, you may recall, there's a difference between the understanding of how things really are and who you really are from an intellectual point of view and versus a non-conceptual point of view. Intellectual point of view involves words and concepts. And then we mistake our words and our concepts for what it is that we're talking about, which is something that cannot be talked about. So then when we mistake that, when we mistake, you know, when we mistake the thing, the experience for our description of the experience, then we are once again involved in this kind of separation. We're involved in this, well, I had the direct perception of emptiness, that's not the same as someone who, you know, meets God face to face. You see? Same experience. Different words describing it. And then people fight about the words. Okay. Huge battles over the course of millennia, you know, between religions or even within religions on, you know, well, you know, What is that experience? We have a better description of that experience than you do. Our description of that experience is the true experience. You had a minor version of it and called it something else. You know, all of these battles over words. They're all fingers, words and concepts and stuff are just fingers pointing at the indescribable moon. That which is without concept, non-conceptual. The self-consciousness ends. Therefore, there cannot be words. And then, you know, people get into big finger wars with each other. Whose finger is better than whose finger? Whose finger is pointing more accurately at that which cannot be described? And, you know, I'll tell you a quick joke on this. They say that religion is like a swimming pool. All the noise is coming from the shallow end. All the bickering, all the divisiveness, all the schisms, all the fighting about, you know, who's got it right according to, you know, what words you say, what concepts you have. All of that is, you know, spiritually juvenile. The ultimate truth cannot be put into words. The ultimate identity that we have is not somebody. It's not something. It's nobody or everything, or everybody. Nothing or everything. And then people fight about that. No, you said nothing. You said everything's empty, and we say everything's full. See, you said everything's full, we say everything's empty. Shunyata, we're the shunyata guys. Yay, shunyata. Emptiness. And you all got it wrong because you think things are full. Plenitude. You say Atman, I say Anatman. You say potato, I say potato. These are just words. And then people like have big fights about them. These are just concepts. This is just the intellect at work, okay? This is just the mind. Churning. Vritti. Churning, churning, churning all the time. So when the mind settles down, when the self-consciousness ends, when the little voice inside shuts up already, then we experience what is true. Then we have an experience of what is real. You know, apart from below all of the, you know, the words, the chatter, the gossip, the noise. We hear the silence, which makes noise possible. Right? Words are made possible because of the silence in between words. Right? The fullness is made possible, the multitude of things is made possible by the emptiness that those things can exist in. Right? The donut is made possible by the hole in the middle. And so, like, try to get to the hole instead of worrying about the donut. You know? What do you call that thing around it? The flower. The sprinkles. Don't worry about the sprinkles. So the yoga, the path outlined in the Yoga Sutra leads to the same goal that they all lead to. All paths lead to the same destiny. All authentic paths lead to the same destination. And the further on you get along the path, the more you know that you don't know. The more you know that your concepts, your dogmas, your doctrines are fallible. Are incomplete at best, are approximations at best towards what cannot be said, what cannot be described. So that's where yoga is leading us. And in this last class, we get to some pretty heavy stuff coming from the third and then fourth chapter. So that's enough because we have something to do tonight. Lot to do to finish up, but heavy stuff. You ready? So I call this class Full Integration. Samadhi. Full integration means the collapse of the sense that there's a difference between the subject and the object. The collapse of the sense that there's a difference between you and me. Between me and the world and so forth. The integration into life rather than the separation from life that self-consciousness always entails. grasping to self, grasping to the individual self, always entails separation. And therefore, isolation, a feeling of separation, isolation, being cut off, being alone. And good news is that none of us have ever been alone. We have always been and always will be in relationship. We are always in a network, a nexus. And in fact, we're not nodes in a nexus. We are the nexus. The idea that we're nodes in a network then kind of reinforces the idea of a separate me that then makes connection. We are the network, ultimately. So when the vrittis stop, right, when there is a cessation, then the seer sees his or her true nature, perceives, you know, in a non-conceptual way, perceives who they really are. All right, here we go. So we talked of, one more thing, here we go, lead up here, one more lead up. And then one of the methods talked about in the Yoga Sutra is to go through the eight angas, the eight limbs of yoga. Yama niyama, restraints on yourself, pretty much. The yamas are restraining yourself from hurting others, from stealing from others, from lying to others, from sleeping with others that you shouldn't sleep with, and from being greedy. And then the niyamas, these are directed towards others, really, right? Shaucha means like keeping clean vis-a-vis, you know, what you put into your body and what you put in front of your mind. Tapas, so austerity, you know, learning to discipline yourself so that you're not just rogue, running around like a rogue elephant. Then santosha, contentment vis-a-vis others, vis-a-vis the world around you. Not always wanting more and not always pushing things away that you didn't want. Svadhyaya, study. And the study here means study about a spiritual thing, not studying mechanics, not studying philosophy, not studying, you know, comparative religion, but studying how things are, studying the true nature of the world, studying who you are, learning who you are. Sva means self. So another translation of svadhyaya is learning who you are, self-study, figuring out who you are. And then Ishvara Pranidhana, surrendering to the higher power, giving up your, you know, yourself, your lower self, so that you can get in touch with your higher self. Can't get in touch with your higher self while you're grasping to your lower self. So Ishvara means your higher self, means who you really are. Also, Lord, the Lord. The Lord is not different from you. God is not different from you. We are all God. And then you say that in the Western context, historically, and they start like, you know, the kindling, you know, from the fire. You go around saying, I am God. But in, you know, in the Eastern traditions, there's no worries about that. They've been saying that for all the time. And nobody gets like too much of a, you know, ruffled about it. Because that is true. We are the ultimate. We are not different from the ultimate. Our deeper nature. But that's not you say your name to yourself. Okay? So don't get the wrong idea saying, yeah, I, Marut, am God. Then you can definitely start the kingdom, okay? If you say that kind of thing, because that's megalomania. That's like, you know, kind of clinical. It's like some kind of like whatever it is, clinically megalomania. So it's not you as an individual who is God, but you in your deeper nature and God are not different. They are the same. The higher power, the Ishvara. So worship that, you know. Bow down to that. It's not a matter of bowing down to someone else or to some like statue or something like that. It's bowing down to your deepest nature. And that is something we should all have great respect for. We should have great respect for who we really are. That's the ultimate source of self-esteem. The ultimate source of self-esteem is to get rid of the self that you're already esteeming. And to get in touch with your real self. And esteem that. So those are the two first limbs, the yamas and niyamas, the restraints and the precepts. Then comes asana practice. Learning how to, you know, control your body. To keep your body happily, steadily. Happy and steady, right? Sukha and sthira. Yeah, and that includes in your asana practice, but also all day long. keeping your physicality, you know, content, happy, and stable, not bouncing off of walls all the time. Then comes pranayama, the use of the physical breath to control the inner energies, working from the outside in, using your physical breath, controlling it, calming it, and so forth, which calms the inner energies. Then pratyahara, restraint, withdrawing. They use the image often of a turtle withdrawing its limbs into itself, withdrawing the senses into yourself. And then you're ready for the next limbs, which is dharana, putting your mind on an object without wavering. Then jhana, keeping your mind there for a while. And then finally to where we begin tonight, samadhi, the last of the eight amas. Ready? Full integration is awareness of the mere appearances of objects just as they are. They are indeed empty of having any true nature. Svarupa shunya iva. Iva can mean it's like they're empty of any true nature. And some people translate it like that. It's like they're empty of any true nature. But it can also kind of be an emphasis. Indeed, they are indeed empty of all nature. So it can go either way. This is one of the most important verses in the Yoga Sutra when it comes to wisdom. Remember, the third main component of any, you know, complete practice. First component is, you know, physical, including ethics, right? Learning how to comport yourself in the world. Then meditation, and then wisdom. Meditation means like learning how to control your mind. Physical means learning how to control your body and your actions. Then meditation, learning how to control your mind. And then wisdom, using your mind for what it was meant for. The mind wasn't meant to just go on this acid trip all the time. The vritti spinning out of control, the churnings, the turbulence of the mind. The mind was meant to bring us to reality. And so that's kind of what he's saying here. This is the definition of samadhi. The definition of it, tat eva artha matra nirbasa. Nirbasa means appearance. Matra means just that much. Artha means, or mere. Artha means the way things are. Tat eva, that's the way it is. To see things that the way they are. Okay? So it's not saying you don't see nothing. Samadhi is not like, oh, I, you know, just like blip out into the big void or something like that. You know? It means that you live in the world of appearances. This is the world of appearances. Things appear. Orchids appear. You know, water appears. Things appear. Right? But you understand them as mere appearances. You don't get caught in the idea that they have some kind of existence other than the way they do exist. They exist as appearances and they work fine as appearances. Okay? It's like a dream. In a dream, things work too, don't they? You know, if you're in a dream and, you know, like cars are flying by or something like that, and also in a dream, if you're caught up in the dream, you think it's real, don't you? And, you know, like in The Matrix, you all seen The Matrix? When they're plugged into The Matrix, which is a dream. The Matrix, the whole Matrix is a dream. But when they're having fights and stuff, they bleed there in the Nebuchadnezzar, you know, sitting there all like hooked up into The Matrix. You know, they start bleeding and stuff. It works. It functions. Dreams function. They work. But a lucid dreamer doesn't get caught up in the dream. So you could say samadhi is the state of lucid dreaming, of understanding that it is a dream, that all appearances are a dream. And then you don't get caught up in it. And then you can truly have equanimity, right? Truly be chillax. Truly, like, you know, step away, step back from what is just unfolding, you know, temporary passing appearances, right? Everything arises, lasts for a while, and then dissipates. That's the nature of this life, right? Everything. You included, of course. You're born, you last for a while, you know, you get decrepit, and then you die. And then some new thing comes over and over and over again. And every moment is like that. Every moment arises, it has its like fling as a moment, and then it passes away over and over and over again. And a lucid dreamer, a dreamer in samadhi, sees it just like that. And like a dream. It's like a dream. So they, you know, they're still active. They still interact with appearances. A person in samadhi would still live in the same world that we do. A world of appearances. But and they would be active, you know. How else could you live? You can't just like, you know, I'm in samadhi, I can't do anything, you know. They would interact. They would interact with people. Interact. Go to job, maybe. Maybe they have a job. Maybe a person in samadhi hasn't figured out how to retire yet. But they would live very differently in the inside. The outside wouldn't look different. They would still be active. They would still row their boats. You know, row, but gently. Gently down the street. You know? Merrily, happy, happy, merrily, merrily, merrily. Because life is but a dream. They know life is just a dream. That's the sutra of row your boat. Full awareness is awareness of the mere appearances of objects just as they are. So the mere appearances of objects is just how they are, actually. They're just mere appearances. They last for a while and then they dissipate. And they don't. And somebody in samadhi doesn't like freeze frame everything, you know, with the mind. The mind freeze frames things. The mind freeze frames things through words and concepts. Because we're stuck in language in a way. Our minds are imprisoned by language. There was an academic who wrote a book called The Prison House of Language, because we're stuck in it. And We don't think that we can think without language. And we can't think conceptually without language. Right? Language is what we call thinking. We think in words and concepts. Right? And so, because we have words, because we can't think, we think we can't think in any other way without than using words and language. We are imprisoned by them. So we say orchid. And then we think, well, because I have a word for it, because I have a concept for it, it must be a thing. Yeah? Freeze frame. Orchid. It must be a thing. Words are signifiers. You know, this is, you know, from linguistics. They're signifiers. The word orchid signifies this. And then we mistake our signifiers for the signified. We think that there are signified things that our signifiers signify. You see what I mean? So, you use the example of the river. You know, which river is it here? Colorado. The mini Colorado, is it? So we have a word, Colorado River. River. And then we think, well, that must be something. Rivers are just process. Just flowing water, constantly changing flowing water. And they are most obvious to us as like something that's obviously changing moment to moment, right? But everything's like that. Everything is like that. Upon analysis, if you can like dig deep into what it means to say that everything is changing, you know, everything is impermanent. Is that correct or not? Is this a changing thing or an unchanging thing? You see, everyone kind of gets that, right? Someday this will wither and, you know, the petals will fall off. It's changing, right? But then if you dig deep into change, what does it mean to say it's a changing thing? How often is it changing? How does change work, actually? Does it stay the same and then change and then stay the same, you know? Or is it changing nanosecond by nanosecond? And of course, intellectually, I think you can get to it pretty easily that it has to be changing nanosecond by nanosecond. It's not stay the same, change like that. That's not how change works. Nanosecond by nanosecond. So if you get there, then you can say, well, then what is it that's changing exactly? Because if we say the orchid is changing, we've already got it wrong. Because the orchid implies something that isn't changing. The very name, the very language that we use, the very concepts that we use, freeze frames reality. You know? So that we're fooled. We're fooled by our own thinking into thinking that there are things that aren't changing. To say that there is an orchid that is changing is already a contradiction in terms. You see what I mean? An orchid that's changing nanosecond by nanosecond. How can there be an orchid? Really, you see? So the samadhi process is getting below conceptual thought. Getting free from our own minds. From our own minds and the way that our minds imprison us and deceive us through language and conceptions. Language and names. Names and things. Names for things can confuse us about the nature of so-called things. There are no things. You could say it like that. There are really no things. There's just movement. There's just process. And we are very fortunate, you know, to live in a time where our own scientists are saying the same thing. You know, if you listen to what the modern physicists say, it sounds pretty much just like that, only it's a lot harder to understand. But that's kind of what they're getting at. That there really are no things, you know. So full integration is awareness of the mere appearances of objects just as they are. They are changing. You could say they're changed. It's change. You see objects as change, not as objects in a way. They are indeed empty of having any true nature. They don't have a swarupa. They don't have a... There's no essential orchid here. You see? And when we say orchid, we already essentialize it. We already say, well, it is something. It is an orchid. See? But it is empty of having any true nature. It is just process. It is just flow. And the same is true with you. It's not just orchids. You have no true nature. Or you could say, your true nature is the absence of true nature. And that is your true nature. And a lot of texts fool around with it like that, including the Yoga Sutra. You know, they talk about Svarupa, you know, understanding who you really are, your true nature. But upon reflection, your true nature is the absence of any true nature. Or you could say it is the plenitude of all nature. Either one comes to the same thing. You are either nothing or everything. Right? If you want to think of yourself as if you want to think of your true nature as everything, if that makes you feel better, think of it that way. But it comes to the same thing. If you're everything, you're nothing. But you're definitely not something. Your true nature is definitely not some particular thing. You see, as opposed to other particular things. That's how you appear. That's the mere appearance of things. I appear to be different than you. You appear to be different from me. The chairs appear to be different than the butts that are sitting on the chairs. That's appearance. But at the deeper level, you can say everything is either one or nothing. It comes to the same thing. You say everything is the fullness, the wholeness, the plenitude, or you say everything is the emptiness. Everything is the absence of everything, of anything, of any particular thing. See? Absence and plenitude are the same thing. Complete self-control. So now we move on to a whole section in the third chapter, that goes into what's called samyama. Samyama. It means, I've translated here, complete self-control. It means literally to hold together, or to control in that sense, to bring, to hold like the reins together, you know? And this phrase is defined here. Complete self-control is when these three, concentration, meditation, and full integration, what are those three? Where did we hear of those three before? Yeah, this is dharana, jhana, and samadhi. This is the last three of the limbs of yoga. So when these three, come together. That's self-control. That's complete self-control. When the focus is there, when the ability to hold the focus is there, and when the distance between the subject and the object collapse, when there is integration between the perceiver and the perceived, then that's what they're talking about here as complete self-control. Enlightened wisdom arises from that mastery. Prajna aloka. You could also say the light of wisdom. That's when wisdom arises, prajna. I'll just put one thing on the board just because like I can give up one time at least in this class. This word prajna is a very interesting one. Prajna. The nya in prajna, pra is a prefix, is equal to the English combination gn and kn. In Sanskrit, this is as funky in Sanskrit as these two are in English. So a lot of people like say dhyana with the G-N-Y-A, because nobody knows really how to pronounce it. Dhyana or dhyana or dhyana. It's really hard to pronounce. This is the N in like the Spanish mañana, and then you put a J in front of it, dhyana. Sounds like you're sneezing or something. And similarly, you know, GN, like, there's a word like this. How do you pronounce that? Gnosis. No, you're going to be able to make the G start. Gnosis. And prajna and gnosis mean exactly the same, pretty much exactly the same. Wisdom. And then we also have this one. Knowledge, yeah. Okay? So prajna means, you know, is especially a synonym with the English gnosis. Gnosis doesn't mean knowledge in the sense of facts, you know, data collecting or something like that. It means a deep understanding that transforms you. And that's what prajna is too. So the light of this kind of wisdom arises with the combination of the three, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Concentration, meditation, and full integration. Enlightened wisdom arises. The application of this, then with that kind of, you know, tool, that kind of synthesis that occurs because of those three, comes about in stages, he says. So it doesn't happen all at once. You learn to concentrate. You learn to meditate, that is holding the concentration for long periods of time, and then you learn, you know, the integration part, the understanding of how things really are, the dropping of the distance between you and the world around you. And that he says comes in stages. And then the next verse is the three parts of complete self-control are the internal components of yoga as compared to the previous ones. So all up to dharana, all up to concentration, you can regard as external yoga. Okay? All the yamas, the niyamas, the restraints, the precepts, pranayama, pratyahara, asana, these are all external. And then the last three are regarded as the inner yoga. And then I've skipped a lot of verses between this last one, 3.7, and the next one, 3.37. Because then he goes into this big thing, you know, that goes on and on, actually. There's many, many verses in the third chapter that deal with what are called the siddhis. Siddhi, S-I-D-D-H-I. And the siddhis are supernatural powers that you are supposed to get and in your advanced stages of yoga. And, you know, there's no real need to go into this. I mean, you know, we already have most of them. You know, the ancients thought, well, you know, it'd be really cool if I really got advanced as a spiritual practitioner. You know, I could see things, you know, from long distances away. I could hear things, you know, from long distances. I could travel very fast. I could travel underground very fast. You know, all of these kinds of, like, you know, magical powers. They regarded, or I could fly. All of these kinds of magical powers that we take for granted. That we just said, well, you know, of course I can fly. I just go to the Austin airport and I get on a plane and I fly. You know, and then, I've done this rap many, many times, and especially among some kind of, like, hardcore yoga people, like Orthodox yogis. they said, no, that's not a city. You have to use a plane. Like, they had the idea that a real city would be that you go flap, 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 like that, without a plane, and you could just, like, fly like that, or Superman. And, you know, Cindy once said a couple of years ago that, very, very wisely, I thought, when maybe in your immediate past life, you got the city of being able to fly. And then, and in that kind of way that, like, you know, you thought you should supposed to get that up. So, you know, you put on, you start flying around like this, above the, you know, city limits of Austin, and, you know, you find out that, like, there's a lot of wind, and, like, the bugs are all, like, you know, like that, and it's very kind of uncomfortable. So then you decide, well, you know, I'm going to perfect that city a little bit. I'm going to be able to fly while sitting in a comfortable chair with a, you know, steward or stewardess bringing me drinks with a little TV screen here. You know, much better way to fly, wouldn't you say? So anyway, we won't go into all of those cities. The next verse that I've picked, 37, is really important. These supernatural powers, these cities, when they become distractions, are troublesome to one's full integration. And this is very typical in yoga texts. You know, they all assume that you can get all kinds of like powers like this. And then they always say, but don't get hung up on it. Don't think that that's the goal. That's not samadhi. The ability to play with all of our toys, our magical toys, you know, is not samadhi. It's very useful. It can potentially be very, very useful. You know, the ability to communicate with each other instantaneously, the ability to go from one part of the continent to the other in just a couple of hours, potentially very useful. But the danger here is that they become distractions. And I suggest to you that we are all very distracted by our cities. We are very distracted by the television and the computer and the MP3 player and all of these other kind of magical things that we have. And then we forget. We kind of forget, like, what we're supposed to be doing with this life. And what the purpose of these kinds of gadgets really should be. I mean, potentially, like I said, amazing. You know, We for the first time in world history, have the ability to know about each other globally. You know, for the first time, really, to really have an intimate awareness, an intimate knowledge of people around the world, and what's happening around the world, and, you know, like that, which is potentially a major, like, kind of boon. You know, because we can then really understand that we're all the same, that we're all human beings living, you know, the same kind of human lives and stuff. It could potentially bring us to a kind of a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood that in the past it would be very hard to work to get at. Because in the past people lived parochial lives. They lived isolated lives, they lived ethnocentric lives and so forth. And then, you know, they didn't know about other people really. And so then they had all these imaginings about who they were. You know, prejudices. Biases and so forth. It's much harder to maintain prejudice when you actually know somebody else. You know, when you actually know about their lives. So, you know, there are potentially wonderful things cities are potentially very wonderful, but they can very easily become distractions. So already, like, you know, 1500, 2000 years ago, Patanjali is warning us, don't get distracted by your wizardry. By your gadgetry and wizardry and, you know, Hogwarts life. All all of these magic toys that we have. And that's mostly how we use them, as playthings, as toys. We have this amazing, you know, computers and stuff and internets, and then, you know, we sit around and watch 3D games on them, you know. All right. Because one remains imperturbable, Vairagya makes another appearance here. Even when it comes to that, to the attainment of those spiritual. So then you get that detachment again. Vairagya comes up. So you get all these magical powers and stuff. And then you say, well, big deal, you know. If they're useful, I'll use them. If I can use them for a helpful thing, fine. But I'm not going to get attached to them. Vairagya. You get this kind of imperturbability, this kind of detachment from this this kind of, you know, ability. Because one remains imperturbable, even when it comes to that, the attainment of supernatural powers, autonomy, arises when the seeds for all faults are destroyed. So here we get, I think, one of the first, if not the first, appearance of the word Kaivalya. Kaivalya. K-A-I-V-A-L-Y-A. Kaivalya. And this is the goal in yoga. This is another word that describes the ultimate goal of yoga. Kaivalya means, it means isolation or detachment. I've put it as autonomy, because then... Because that's kind of what autonomy is, isn't it? It's this kind of like ability to be on your own. Autonomy. So no dependence on anything else. And that's another way of describing the ultimate state. The ultimate state, even in Buddhism, sometimes they say that Buddhahood is an independently existing state. Independent. So another, you know, another sort of connotation of this is in other Indian traditions, they talk about the goal as moksha, or mukti, which means freedom, which is also autonomy, right? Freedom. Not being tied to anything. So kaivalya, autonomy arises when the seeds for all faults, dosha bija, dosha means fault. Problem, blame, error. Bija means the seeds. Our chaya are destroyed. So now we get into like sections about like, you know, how do we do that as we move towards autonomy, as we move towards the final goal, liberation. The karma of a yogi is neither black, white nor black, but for others it is of the three types. So he's mentioned two types of karma. The third type would be gray. Good, bad, and sort of neutral. That's the karma that most people have. Then he says, the karma of a yogi, somebody who's like moving very quickly now towards the final goal, is neither white nor black. In other words, it transcends good and evil. Transcends good karma and bad karma. So what makes good karma, white in this case, you know, this is how they describe it, white is the term for good karma, and what makes black karma or bad karma, bad karma? And, you know, I talked about it the other day in the yoga studio, which one of those yoga studios, kind of all becoming a blur now. But it's a matter of intention. What is your intention? Is your intention altruistic, selfless, kind, compassionate? Then it's good karma. If the intention is selfish, self-centered, you know, aggressive, and so forth, then it's bad karma. And if it's kind of like in between, like it's kind of like, you know, whatever. If it's whatever, then it's kind of neutral karma. So how does a yogi escape karma? You know, another version of the problem in the Yoga Sutras, klesha and karma, okay? The problem. Klesha and karma, or the cause of the problem. The problem is, you know, is our minds are all screwed up. And why are our minds all screwed up? Because of klesha, mental afflictions, and karma, the karma that mental afflictions inspire, okay? The actions that mental afflictions inspire. And all actions for an ordinary person, are inspired by some form of pleasure. So you could say there are no really, in the strong sense, in the absolute sense, there's no good karma for anyone. Because karma is always, the intention is always kind of inspired by at least some form of a mental affliction. You know, it may be inspired by altruism and so forth, but for an ordinary person, there is no pure altruism. There's always self-centeredness somewhere in the action, right? Self-centeredness, self-concern. You know, maybe you're very kind, maybe you're very generous, but, you know, who is it that's being kind and generous? Right? It's me. It's an I. It's an individual me. And oftentimes it's even worse than that. I'm very kind and generous so that other people will see me as kind and generous. I'm very, very, very altruistic so that other people will think I'm such a good practitioner. Right? So always infected. You have to say relatively good, relatively bad. I mean, you know, some even very, very negative acts have like usually have some kind of at least deluded idea that you're doing it for the good. You know, have you noticed that in your own mind? Like even when you're yelling and screaming at someone, you think, well, this is for their own good. I'm such a generous person here, yelling and screaming and hurting them and so on. So it's relative to them. So how does a yogi get to the point where the karma is neither white nor black? If karma is in general inspired by intention, what they call sankalpa is, you know, your motivation or intention, why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I'm thinking what I'm thinking, why I'm saying what I'm saying, then the way to escape karma is to have no intention. To have no motivation. You see? Someone who is acting without motivation isn't really an actor at all. Okay? Then they have not, they're not involved in the karmic process because there's no I who is acting. Okay? So if you take the I, if you take the motivation out, if you take intention out, then who is acting? If there's no why, then there's no who either, right? So when for example, we act without motivation, without intention, it is when we're not there. It is when the self-consciousness is out of the equation. The self-consciousness always has motivation, always involves intention. So when are those, you know, when are those experiences? Like when we are, you know, deeply engrossed in a hobby, for example. You know, something that we really love doing. Some people really love their work. When you're deeply involved in your work, when you're in the flow, that's what the psychologists call it nowadays. Getting into the flow state. The flow state is defined by the absence of self-consciousness. You vacate. And you merge with the action itself, see? So when you're merged with the action, when the action is done for its own sake, not for with an intention of what I'm going to get out of it, whether I'll benefit from it, and so forth, then you could say there is no actor. There's just action. See? The actor is vacated. The self is gone. And the integration, the samadhi, is possible. But the actor and the action become one. So that's why the yogi, the karma of the yogi is neither white or black, because they have radically re-identified themselves. They're in the process, at least, of radically re-identifying, of losing, of dropping the asmita. Remember asmita? The idea of selfness, I am-ness, the egoism, which is the second of the main mental afflictions, right? Following from avidya, following from ignorance. Ignorance then leads us to think, I am acting. I am the actor. And if you think that, then you also think, and I am acting for some reason. Right? Not just randomly and whatever. That's craziness. But in ordinary like life, ordinary sane life, I always act for a reason. I always, you know, I am acting utilitarian, in a utilitarian manner. What am I going to get out of it? So with the wising up, with the end of avidya, with the end of ignorance, also comes the end of asmita, of thinking that there actually is an I who is acting. See? Of dropping the idea that there's some kind of, you know, mini-me in there, an entity, you know. And realizing that it's just flow, it's just process. And so if there's not a me who is acting, there is no actor, and therefore there is no karma. This is also the teaching in the Bhagavad Gita, of course. Karma Yoga. This is what Karma Yoga means in the Bhagavad Gita. Which is a text that this text probably knew about. I mean, you know, these guys are all in conversation. Karma Yoga means the yoga, the discipline of acting in such a way that you're not thinking about the fruits of action. You're not thinking about what you're going to get out of it, which means that you have no intention. It means that you have no sankalpa. Right? If you're not thinking about what you're going to get out of it, in what sense do you have an intention? Intentions are always about what I'm going to get out of it, aren't they? This is also, so it's taught in the Bhagavad Gita also. This is how you escape karma. This is not escaping karma by not acting. Of course we act. Can't help but act. But how can we act without getting bound in the karmic system? The karmic system of, you know, cause and effect, retribution, reward, and all of that, over and over and over again. So these are methods, you know, for achieving that. In the Buddhist tradition, Mahayana Buddhist tradition, this is exactly what's meant by bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, the wish to get enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. So a bodhisattva, someone who has bodhicitta, is acting not as himself or herself. They're not acting with an ego. It's not like, I am a bodhisattva, I'm going to save everybody. They are acting as everybody. See? They're acting as everybody, not for everybody. They have radically re-identified themselves. Radically re-identified themselves with the whole instead of any one part of the whole. And it comes to the same thing. No actor then. No individual actor. If you're everybody, then you're not any one somebody. You see. You have to be somebody to collect karma. Okay? So you can be nobody, or you can be everybody, but if you're either one of them, you're not going to collect any karma. Because you're not somebody. You're not an individual. You're not attached to the ego. You're not attached to the individual actor. You're not attached to the self-consciousness. You're not attached to intention. You know, so they also say the bodhisattva who has true bodhicitta, acts in an uncontrived way. Uncontrived way means no forethought. No sitting around going, I'm a bodhisattva, how can I help all sentient beings? I should be all sentient beings. You know, none of that. It's all automatic because of this radical re-identification of who you really are. These are people who are getting in touch with their true nature, you see? Still acting in the world, but in touch with their true nature. As everybody or nobody, depending on how you want to look at it, comes to the same thing. They're just not somebody anymore. Because there is unity underlying all transformation, there is reality to things. So this one I threw in because it's kind of interesting. The Yoga Sutra, you know, is a very deep philosophical text. And here he says, things do exist because there is a unity underlying all transformation. So everything exists in a changing fashion, right? Everything is transforming all the time, nanosecond by nanosecond. But it's all happening in the same universe. It's all happening in the same reality. So there's a unity, the same reality. There's a unity underlying all transformation. Then you can say that things are real. They are happening in a real place, in a real cosmos, in reality they are happening. But they're happening as change. They are happening as transformation. So he's not saying here, as other traditions would say, like Advaita Vedanta, that things are merely illusory. That everything is just maya, it's just illusory. No, they're real. They're real because because they are undergirded by reality. They are happening in reality. But they're happening as changing things, as mere appearances of things. Changing. Underlying all transformation is a unity. While things share a certain sameness, samya, everything is happening in the same reality. There's only one reality, by the way. I mean, how could there be more than one reality? That's science fiction, where they, you know, you go from one reality to another. You know, if it's real, it's the only real thing. You know, there's only one reality. So it's just a matter of understanding, like, how things exist in reality. It's not that they don't exist, or they exist in a different reality, but how do they exist in reality? And here he says, you know, they exist as transformation, as parinama. And while things share a certain sameness, they all exist in the same reality. Because of the differences in minds, two things are divided in different ways. So why would reality appear so different to a person who is moving towards samadhi than it does for us? Is it different realities that they're living in? Is it an enlightened being living in a different reality? Or are they just perceiving the same reality in two different ways? From different way from us. So in the Buddhist texts they say, for example, nirvana is samsara. Even Nagarjuna says that. Like full on. Nirvana, you know, the realization of an ultimate reality, is samsara. It means it's not somewhere else. It's not a different reality. These are just two versions, these are two perspectives on the same thing. So someone in samadhi, someone who's moving towards samadhi at least, would see this orchid quite differently than you and I see this orchid. But they're seeing the same orchid. They're seeing what we call an orchid, right? They're seeing the same reality. But just understanding it, because they understand it so differently, they would see it quite differently. They would perceive it quite differently. That's what he's saying. Things are the same. An orchid is an orchid, you know. A rose is a rose by any other name. Isn't that what they call it? But because of the differences in minds between, for example, an unenlightened mind and an enlightened mind, two things are divided in different ways. They appear differently. An object is not tied to one single mind for existence. I like this verse very much. This is a verse that that people who think that they're projecting their own reality should cut out and put on their refrigerator. An object is not tied to one single mind for its existence. For if it were, what would happen to it when it was not being perceived by that one mind? See, this is the counter to this kind of megalomaniac idea that of solipsism, what's called solipsism. You know what solipsism means? That I'm the only one in the universe. That I am projecting the whole universe. You are all just my projections. So what would happen to you if I weren't projecting you anymore? Well, I guess you'd just disappear then. Because I'm projecting the universe. And he's saying, come on. You know, it's not just one mind that's projecting the universe. Everyone, you could say, is projecting their own universe. But no one person is projecting the universe. You see what I mean? Yeah. So this is a very useful, you know, kind of corrective to this, again, solipsistic idea. The idea that, you know, it's just me that exists somehow. Other beings, you know, probably exist. You know, seems like it, doesn't it? Not just you. An object is either known or unknown, depending on whether the mind is aware of it or not. So now he kind of drops the other shoe. Yep. And says, well, you know, for any individual, you know, an object comes into existence when it is known. A knowable thing and an existing thing are synonyms. Okay? When you know something, it comes into existence. Which also means that you could say that unless you know it, it does not exist. For you. Okay? So, like, take the example of the New World, you know? was that did the New World exist for Europeans before it was discovered by Columbus or whoever the hell, the Vikings or whoever it was? Huh? Did it exist? It wasn't known. So it did. In what sense could you say that for them, the New World had existed? Now, for the Native Americans, it probably existed. It certainly, right? Not as the New World, of course. It existed as home. But for Europeans, in what sense could you say that the New World existed before it was known? It came into existence when it was known. And that's the case with every one of us, too, as individuals. And then you could say, well, you know, I've never seen the Eiffel Tower, you know, but it exists. I know it exists because other people have seen the Eiffel Tower. Well, what is it exactly that you know, then? You know other people's reports of the Eiffel Tower, right? So you know that, you know, other people have reported that the Eiffel Tower exists. That's what you know. But actually, unless you've actually seen it, you know, you don't know that it exists. Well, I saw a photo of it. Well, what do you know? You know that there's a photo of the Eiffel Tower. And a photo of the Eiffel Tower exists for you. But you see, unless you've had a perception, unless you've had a pretty direct perception, that you don't really know that it exists. You know that a report of it exists, a story of it exists, a photograph exists, a movie of it exists, but you don't know that it exists until you have a direct perception of it. You know? So that's kind of a principle of logic, actually, which is very useful. It helps us, if we can remember it, it helps us to contain ourselves with what we actually do know. You know, and not extend, you know, our ideas about things beyond what we really do know. For the one who can make the proper distinctions, vishesha darshana. Vishesha means the distinction between things. Darshana means somebody who can see that. There is an end to speculation about the existence of the true self. The Atman. So for someone who can make a distinction between the apparent self and the true self, there's an end of debate about whether there's a true self or not. Because they know. They've distinguished between what appears to be myself and who my true self really is. Then the mind, deep in discrimination, viveka, discriminating between what's apparent and what's deep, more deeply real, moves towards haivalya. Moves towards autonomy, moves towards identifying with the capital S self, with the true self, with the true nature, and de-identifying with the mere appearances of things. When there are lapses in discrimination, it's because of intervening factors that arise due to mental imprints, vasana, samskara. Samskaras are memories, really. Samskaras are memories. So, you know, these verses are talking about someone who's getting very near the goal, but not quite there. So they have lapses. And those lapses come from, like, old habits, old understandings, old memories of, you know, thinking about things. The way that, and seeing things the way that, you know, they used to see them. So a little relapse once in a while. It is said that they can be destroyed, just like the mental afflictions. What? The samskaras. The old mental imprints. Just like the kleshas, the mental afflictions can be destroyed, so too can karma. You know, the samskaras are karmic seeds. They're memories. They're karmic predilections, predispositions. And a lot of what happens to us as, you know, kind of ordinary people are due to those predispositions. A lot of our lives are ruled by that. By just habit, right? The habit of thinking and doing things the way that we've always done. So here he's talking again about a kind of a radical re-identification. I am not my memories. Okay? We are as individuals, as unenlightened individuals, nothing other than our memories, you could say. Who would you be without memory? Quick. What would your name be? You know? What would your feelings be? Who would you be in any sense without memories? So So we are who we think we once were. Now, that's what defines us as snowflake, unique little individuals. Because we have different sets of memories, right? Different sense of different habits, different predilections. So when you destroy your memories, you're destroying your sense of self. Your individual sense of self. And that's kind of what he's pointing to here. It's said that they can be destroyed. I am not who I think I once were. Okay? They're just brain farts. Okay? No, they're just... Memories are not like, videotapes of what actually happened. We're all aware of that, right? They're constantly being reinterpreted by the present mind. And they only exist in the present mind, right? That's the only place that memories exist. The past is only memory, and the memory is only what we carry in our present mind. And what we carry in our present mind as memories defines us as to who we think we are. So in the process of radical re-identification, you're going to be dropping those memories. I am not my memories. You know, we say now I am my memories. I am nothing but my memories in a way. So somebody who's on their way to radical re-identification, to samadhi, to kaivalya, that they are losing their memories, kind of literally, as an identifier, see, as an identifier for who they think they are. When one takes no interest even in such karmic accounting, so that's another way of talking about the samskaras, karmic accounting. What I think I said, what I think I did, what I think I thought, those are memories. When one takes no interest in them, full integration, the full integration known as the Dharma cloud, Dharma Megha, is attained by one whose discriminatory viewpoint is complete. The appearance of this term Dharma Megha, Dharma cloud, is kind of interesting because this is usually understood to be a Buddhist term. This is a 10th level bodhisattva. It's a way to describe a 10th level bodhisattva. They entered the Dharma cloud. So there's a lot of speculation, for those of you who care, about whether the Yoga Sutra was influenced by Buddhism or whether Buddhism was influenced by the Yoga Sutra. And it probably goes a little bit both ways. The Dharma cloud is understood by the commentaries, the ancient Sanskrit commentaries, as a technical term for a state of permanent discrimination. So no wavering, no kind of like losing it because the memories pop up, the samskaras pop up again, but a permanent. So the reign of Dharma, but Megha can also mean rain, cloud and rain. So the reign of Dharma is incessant. Yeah, without breaks, it pours down a rain of Dharma. It is then that karma and klesha, mental afflictions, come to an end. So again, it's another reiteration of the problem. Really, the problem is karma and klesha, and the end of that is radical re-identification. I am not my memories. I am not my somebody self. I am not my self-consciousness, but I am the true self, the real self, the capital self, the undistinguishable self, not a particular self. In the Yoga Sutra, they often call this Purusha. I am the cosmic person, the cosmic one. So radical re-identification, and therefore the end of karma and mental afflictions. You can't end either karma or mental afflictions as somebody, as an individual, as somebody grasping onto their sense of individual selfhood. That is the nature, that is the condition of possibility for karma and klesha. Okay? So letting go, gradually, he says in stages, right? Gradually letting go of your complete identification with your particular individuality then leads to this kind of sense of wholeness, of fullness, of completeness, of separation, if you want to call it that way, separation from that lower self, and a complete identification, gradually moving towards a complete identification with your cosmic self. Autonomy is the reversal of qualities that are devoid of meaning for the spirit, for the purusha. I've translated purusha as spirit here. You know, because it kind of, those of us who grew up in the West have that connotations about that, right? The spirit, the Holy Spirit, or the spirit. So it's just another name for the unnameable oneness. Autonomy is the reversal of qualities that are devoid of meaning. Purusha shunya artha. They are empty of meaning to the spirit. Like qualities like this or that, up or down, better or worse, I am, you are, all of these divisions, the dualities, right? It's the reversal of those qualities. Or it could be said, then he says, or if you wanted to think of it differently, it could be said that it is the power of the mind, chitta shakti, when it gets to know its true nature, swarupa pratishta, when it's like firmly grounded in its true nature. When it really realizes who it really is, who you really are. So yoga is, that's the last verse that we'll do. So yoga ultimately is the union, yoga, union, yoki, with this spirit, with this true nature, which underlies all of us and everything, the oneness underlying everything, or the emptiness of everything. Either way, it doesn't matter how you talk about it. It's the same moon, different fingers pointing to it. The radical re-identification with who you really are and the separation or distinction, differentiation from who you think you are. So, I don't know if I've mentioned this to most of you, but I like to think of it nowadays in metaphor terms. You always resort to metaphor when you run out of logic. When the words fail you, you know? We're all like individual waves, right? With our own particularities, peculiarities, talents, failures, you know. We're all individuals. And every individual wave has its own shape, its own duration, and so forth. But every individual wave comes from the same undifferentiated ocean and returns back to the same undifferentiated ocean. So you can like identify and grasp onto your waveness and say, yes, yes, I am the wave. But you know what? That wave will only last a little while and goes back to the sea. And then you won't be you anymore. But where did you come from and where are you going to? You arise from the same ocean and go back to the same ocean. And every wave is the same that way. Each individual wave comes from the same ocean, goes back to the same ocean. And you could also say that even as individual waves, we are just the ocean in motion. The wave is not really different from the ocean. It's just a shape that the undifferentiated ocean makes for a while. You know, like a little cookie cutter. But the ocean is undifferentiated, it is one, and it is the same ocean from which we all come and to which we all return. And realizing the oceanness, you know, identifying with the oceanness rather than with the waveness is the way towards samadhi, the way towards kaivalya. Okay?
The other day I asked you a question about a verse that someone had commented on about the breaches of enlightenment. And that's this verse 4:27.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, really?
I'm wondering if you can see it, why you commented like that. He had said that it's a myth in our culture that we look at enlightened people as being absolutely pure, that they still need to do some purification.
Oh, right.
And they can slip. And you've got cases where gurus are doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
So this is the verse.
Okay. And that verse does say that, that there can be lapses. There can be a backsliding, you could say. But there are verses after that that sort of indicate that there is a state in which there is no backsliding.
Right, yeah. he wasn't saying that it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
The way I understood it is you can reach a certain point where you can say you're quote-unquote enlightened, but there's still some purification, and then there's better stages of enlightenment after.
Yeah.
Or higher stages, but that there is a certain point. How can you call it enlightenment if there's still some
sort of... Well, right, I mean...
That was that interpretation.
The one who speaks about it doesn't know, and the one who knows doesn't speak about it. You go around saying, I'm enlightened, and, well, you better be damn sure. No, in the stories of the Buddha, they do say that this is one of the things that the Buddha... there's a kind of a pride in Buddhahood. You know, the story of when the Buddha arose from the Bodhi tree and preached his first sermon to the guys that he had left early. And one version of that story is when these ascetics who he had been practicing with and then left, you know, to try a different method, which ultimately resulted in his enlightenment, when they saw him coming after his enlightenment, they started jeering and, you know, oh, look at, you know, here comes Gautama, the big loser. You know, he left us. You know, he's not starving to death anymore like we do. And all of that, and you know, some of these stories, the Buddha like raises his hand and says, like, you know, shut up, you know, like, you don't know who you're talking to. You know, this kind of like pride in the attainment. So, but you better have the attainment before you have that pride. And there's plenty of ways that we can fool ourselves on that. Plenty of ways. Like, the story I told you before of having a couple of days go by when you have no problems anymore. Maybe this is it. Maybe I'm in nirvana. People will just disabuse you of that pretty quickly sometimes.
Or go home and visit the family.
Yeah, that's right. Like Ram Dass says. Yeah, just go home and visit your family, see if you're enlightened. Well, this text doesn't deal with it so much, but there are other texts that deal with the phenomenon of what they call jivan mukti, liberation while alive. And the Buddhists also have an idea of this. Nirvana, there's two kinds of nirvana. Nirvana with remainder and nirvana with no remainder. And the remainder, of course, is the body. So, the Buddha went into his nirvana while still living and then taught for like 40 years or something. And then, you know, ate some bad pork or something. I forget how the story goes. And then went into parinirvana, which is nirvana without anything left over, without remainder. So in both the Buddhist texts and the Hindu texts, there is the idea of this kind of liberation while still embodied. And it's just, my best understanding of what they mean by that is that you have a radically different understanding of your body. You know, you are embodied, but you are not your body. There is a radical kind of disengagement with identity with you as a physical body. But you still have one. You know, it's like you're riding around in a rental car. It's not your car, and it's not you, but you're still driving around in it. So the relationship, for example, with pain would be quite different. You know, if you have a body like this, you will have pain. So sometimes people get the idea that they can achieve some kind of embodied enlightenment or embodied liberation and then never suffer pain anymore. And that's impossible. That would be impossible. This is meant to, you know, have pain. It's meant to have pleasure too. You wouldn't have pleasure without pain. Right? There's no pleasure without pain. There's no pain without pleasure, like that. But they would, again, have a very different relationship to pain because it wouldn't be their pain. It wouldn't be identified with the pain. And so there would be pain, but it wouldn't be suffering. There's a difference, right? We suffer because we think it's our pain. we think that pain is happening to me when pain happens to our body. So it's very, you know, it's obviously very hard for us to get our heads around this. You know, it's a very different, obviously, a very different mindset. So we just have to do our best to try to imagine what it would be like. But that's my best guess on it. Yeah, mental imprints, some scars, yeah.
So those are the memories. And so it says, and it said that they can be destroyed just like mental functions, and then maybe I completely list out or something, but how are they destroyed?
Well, they're destroyed by thinking of who you are differently. You know, when we think of ourselves now, we are defined by our memories, right? Our sense of self-identity is intimately tied to the memories that we have, both conscious, subconscious, and unconscious. So that's also need to be said. Samskaras, or vasanas is another term for the same idea, are often regarded as being subconscious or unconscious. But they are definitely definitively definitive. Of who we think we are, right? Of our sense of self. Isn't it? We are who we think we once were. So if you start changing your sense of identity, you know, it's radically expanding or radically diminishing it, either one, you know, taking it to nothing or extending it to everything, then those memories no longer define it. Those memories define a small, individual, particular being.
So then I have a question that you probably get every time, and I'm dumbing it down, but then how do we not sit around as Dharma bums with no accountability?
Without memory, or what?
Like without... I guess it would be easy to say, I'm not my memory, I have no association with that, I've moved on, it is what it is.
Oh, well that would be an individual self-saying. Wouldn't it? That wouldn't be a self that's kind of like radically re-identifying themselves with the whole or the absence of anything, either one. I mean, the whole or the nothingness, the whole or the void. That would be another ego trip. I won't be accountable for my memories. That, generally speaking, almost certainly will not work, number one. And number two, it's just another way that the ego is trying to be somebody, trying to be an individual, trying to they got a word for this now, it's spiritual bypassing. Oh, I read in the Yoga Sutra that I should shed my memories. So instead of actually dealing with the problem of identity that those memories entail, I'll just pretend I don't have memories and kind of move on and maybe move to a different place and start a new life or something. But I don't think that works. Do you think you can do that? I don't even. They follow you around, huh? Because they kind of are you.
The key is to not let them be us.
The trick, it seems to me, is to get vairagya, to have a sense of detachment, impermeability towards all of these questions. The questions not only of memory, but of identity, of who you think you are, to the mental afflictions that arise. I mean, you could sort of also argue that we are our mental afflictions. That's who we are. We're a big bundle of mental afflictions. And so the process is, I think, kind of stepping away little by little by little and saying, that these are happening. Memory is happening. Feelings are happening. These things are happening. But that's not who I really am. I am not my memories. I am not my feelings. I am not my mental conditions. I am more than that. Much more than that. But the lower self, the individual self, is constantly identified with that. So the process is one of gradual detachment, which is not denial. That's different. It's not saying they aren't happening somehow. but it's not fully identifying them and thereby strengthening them. Yeah.
So for the age old question, when factors happen to good people, I have a dear friend, she's experiencing a lot of illness physically, and she's such a good hearted person. What can that be a manifestation of them as far as family? The big question.
It's a huge question, and anybody who tells you that they know the answer to that question is probably just guessing, because no one really knows why things happen like that, you know, at that level of specificity. What's more important, actually, I think, is why does your friend experience it one way and not another? Sickness happens to everyone. Okay? You know, old age happens to everyone. Death happens to everyone. So to ask, well, why did sickness happen? Well, it happens to everyone. You know? Why did it happen to me? Well, because it happens to everyone. But the real question is, you know, why are you experiencing it the way you do? So some people experience sickness in a very, you know, as a huge trauma and so forth. Oh my God, I lost my health. And some people experience it with this kind of nobility. This is the way it is now, so I'll deal. I saw a person just recently, who's like in her 80s or something, he's got huge health problems. It's, you know, she's limping around, she had, you know, had a bad day. I asked her how she's doing, and she says, it's like this now. She repeated back my mantra to me. She had heard it. It's like this now, so I carry on. You know? What's that thing? Something in carry on?
Huh?
Keep calm. Keep calm and carry on. So that's the real question. Why do we experience the things that we do? And that's a much more subtle, you know, kind of question. And a much more knowable one, I think, than why did I get cancer? You know, or why did I get this kind of cancer, not that kind of cancer? You know, we don't know. But we do know, I think, or we can, you know, get at least some sense of why it is that I find sickness to be so important. Well, because I'm very, very attached to health. Why do I find old age to be suffering? Well, I was thinking I was going to be young forever. Mm-hmm. You know, at that level, you can kind of understand it. Okay, one more. Yeah.
Regarding your Be Nobody book, one of your action plans is to not identify with the I and the me and the, to go a day without trying to use that or say that. I'm having a lot of trouble.
Yeah, oh, sure.
I'm having a lot of trouble.
There you go. Very hard practice.
How do you do that?
Yeah, how do you do it? Well, you probably don't do it. You probably fail at doing it, but at least you notice that you're failing, and then you notice how often you do it. That's the kind of point. Just try to go a day without using the first-person pronoun, I, me, or mine, and or even a couple hours, you know, even 15 minutes. And, yeah, the point isn't to succeed at that practice. The point is to, like, recognize, oh, my gosh, you know, look how often it's all about me. Look how often. What is it, Cindy?
Oh, yes,
one more question. Last one.
As we were talking about the latter end of the course here, so much of the considerations are actually in this view. I'm curious as to, is there some level of that the mind would be an outcome to those levels as we start reaching out towards that answer.
Say it again, sorry, the last part especially.
So, when we talk about the mind,
yes,
the sense of mind taking discriminatory powers,
yes.
From the Hindu tradition, there's a sense of, in terms of oneself, the mind would be an atma,
yeah.
The split of your core self.
Yeah.
Is there some that can take precedence or some that may be diminished or left behind, or are they still in concert?
Yeah, I think maybe this is getting at your question. Let's see. There's a recognition, I think, in a lot of traditions from India that there is a difference between consciousness and cosmic consciousness. You know, between the individual consciousness, which is always conscious of something. You know, the mind, manas. And and the producer of the Atman or something, which is regarded as consciousness, but is consciousness which is not conscious of any particular thing. The condition of all consciousness. The condition for all consciousness. Cosmic consciousness. So in the Upanishads, it says Sat Chit Ananda, right? Sat means real. Actually, the way it really is. Chit means some kind of consciousness. And then Ananda means bliss, right? So the bliss leads to a kind of a consciousness that isn't conscious of anything. Or you could say it the other way around. Pure consciousness is entirely blissful because it's not conscious of something. You see? So maybe that's the difference. Yeah, you could say the condition of possibility for all consciousness, which is regarded as a kind of a cosmic consciousness. But it's not conscious. You know, like when we talk about consciousness, it has no sense except for conscious of something. I'm conscious of my feelings, I'm conscious of my thoughts, I'm conscious of something. But it's pure consciousness is the consciousness that isn't conscious of anything, or you could say is consciousness conscious of everything at the same time. And that's kind of like inconceivable to our present consciousness. Yeah, and you're trying to trigger, you know, you're trying to trigger that sort of experience, that kind of samadhi experience that way. But if you are self-conscious of that process, you are not in it. You are not in it. Because then you're conscious of being conscious. Cindy?
I know, I was just
going to
say, because you talk about subtle breath form, that the
yeah.
There's a
level of being that's not quite pure consciousness, but
there's a level that's under gross consciousness, gross conceptual thought, but above pure consciousness.
Yeah, these subtle gradations of subtlety.
Yeah.
Until you get to the clear light.
That's right.
The clear light, the emptiness, the cosmic consciousness.